Welcome back to The Hemingway List, the podcast where we do things the Hemingway. Today we are discussing story 9 from Dubliners called Counterparts, and then we will be reading story 10 called Clay. The questions that I asked the subreddit were these. What do you think the title Counterparts means? Do you like Farrington during this story, before the end? And when did you start to think ill of him? And lastly, fast forward 5 years, where do you see this family and this man? Techrific said, the vocabulary. The tube means communication device within a building. An order on the cashier means an official permission for an advance in wages. Snug is a small private room or a booth in a pub. GP is a glass, a half pint of porter. Caraway, a white flower, biennial herb with spicy, strong-smelling seeds. The seeds, when chewed, were thought to hide the smell of alcohol and thus were offered to customers by turn-of-the-century Dublin bars. Hey, that's a cool little bit of trivia. I wondered why he asked for a caraway seed. Execrate is an archaic word for curse or swear. Mannequin is a little man or a dwarf. Pulled together means got along or been simpatico. Instanter, it means without delay or immediately. The dart means the solution. Stood means a half one or bought a half measure of alcohol. I think stood just means like shout, I'm pretty sure. If you stood that round, it was your shout. It was that round of drinks was on you. The eclogues is a short pastoral poem, often in the form of dialogue between two shepherds. The most famous ones are by the Latin poet Virgil. My nabs is slang for my friend or acquaintance. Irish and Apollinaris is whiskey and soda. Too Irish, slang for exceedingly generous. Chafed means teased good-naturedly. Tincture is a trace, a smattering of alcohol, like a shot. Small hot specials means whiskey mixed with water and sugar. Bitter is bitter, strongly hopped ale. Stood to means bought for. Stripling means is an archaic word for a young man. The curate is the barman, and smahan is a smattering, a smidgen of alcohol. Very cool. Thank you, Techrific, for offering up the slang that we need for this this short story. J.K. Hahn said, Farrington is obviously a drunk and a violent person with anger issues. The ill-thinking came gradually. I first saw him as a guy abused at work, mocked by his uppers. Then he pawned his watch just to have a night's drink, and my opinion of him started going south. He couldn't get a buzz after all the drinks and only got angrier. His anger was about to turn into violence during the arm wrestle and at the end landed on poor Tom. I was shocked and disturbed by the ending, but I probably should have seen it coming. Farrington is unhappy at work, unhappy in his marriage, abused by his wife when not drunk, as narrated by Joyce. I don't think these are new developments. He's probably been living like this for a while. I see in him the potential to sell everything, leave his wife and children on the streets for booze or for a young woman. The future does not bode well for the Farrington family. The religious theme is still strong when Tom begs his dad. He says, I'll say a Hail Mary for you, Pa. This makes me think the children might be abused by their mother as well, who's gone to the chapel at late evening. In Joyce's depictions, religion is always there, overbearing the overt corruption in people's minds. Wasm said, having the barman referred to as the curate made me think of the drinking being something almost like a religious ceremony for the men, with the barman overseeing and administering the communion. Also, with his wife being out at the chapel, both drinking and church could be a form of escapism for the husband and wife, respectively. Religion remains an ineffective form of escape for the kid, however, with his pleading of saying a Hail Mary going unheard through the caning. As to the second question, I started assuming alcoholism as soon as Farrington started speaking of the thirst and absolutely having to sneak out to a drink. Yeah, I think that was when I started to dislike the character, when he snuck out to have a drink in order to finish transcribing a couple of pages. It was a couple of pages, I mean. That's half an hour's work if you really put your mind to it. Probably less if you really put your mind to it. And he just couldn't do it without sneaking out first for a drink. And then he didn't even do it in the end. And, yeah, I don't know. At that point, I was like, I still sympathized with him as the main character. But I started to think, oh, this is one of those stories where I don't really care much about the main character. I didn't realize at that point that we were meant to dislike the character. But yeah, that was where it started. And then certainly by the point where he sold his watch to buy more alcohol, yeah, he was sort of going downhill steeply from there. Swim said the mama fishy said, question one, I did not know this, but apparently one definition of the word is one or two corresponding copies of a legal document. That's the word counterparts. Farley works at a law office, and he is repeatedly failing at copying out a legal document. Okay, so that's what the name refers to. I did not know counterparts meant, like, yeah, a copy, a facsimile of a document. Question two. I was neutral at the start, disliked his boss far more. The two men are stand-ins for England. The boss is from Northern Ireland and probably Protestant. And Ireland. England is treating Ireland very poorly, who is making it very easy for him to do. Once again, Ireland is clueless that by their actions or inactions they are a contributor, and just feel sorry for themselves, or in this case, anger. Also an indictment of the Catholic Church, i.e. the boy crying, I'll say a Hail Mary for you, as he is getting beaten. Prayers won't help. And question three, Farley will be on the streets. His children will be poor urchins running around the streets, his wife working some incredibly crappy job, or relying on handouts from the church. Yeah, things are looking grim for this family. Really kind of... it's really frustrating, isn't it, to read that and just think about his family, about his poor kids, doing their best. Laura Y. Stitch said, did reading this make anyone else thirsty? Not me, I've got to be honest, not really. At the start of this story, I found it quite funny. Yes, he's drinking his money away, but it's not clear that he has a wife and kids to support. And then, at the end, it all collapses into tragedy. It's the saddest one yet, I think. I think so too, because you can see those poor kids have got a terrible future ahead of them, and they're not going to grow into, well, you know, they're going to grow up like their parents, aren't they? Because that's what kids do. G. Warrenardle said, totally, I realized after the fact that I put Jameson on my shopping list today. A good old Jameson. Love a bit of Jameson. The Stealth said, all I could imagine was Bill Burr's dad from this set. And he's linked to a YouTube clip of Bill Burr. I won't play it because of copyright purposes, but I think I know the one he's talking about. Bill Burr's dad was quite aggressive. And Bill Burr does a good comedy set where he talks about it. You can actually, you know what I'll do? I'll open it and find out the title. So if you want to have a look at that. Stop. It's called Bill Burr, How to Raise a Kid. Search that on YouTube. You'll find the clip in question. Starfleet Brat said, well, I think in the case counterparts is referring to Farrington and Elaine. They both have similar behavior. The way that Farrington treats his son is pretty similar to how Elaine was treating Farrington. Ah, very interesting. See, as the story progressed, I started to sympathize with Elaine. Like, he's no doubt a dick to Farrington, but we kind of start to learn that Farrington is kind of a shitty person. So maybe the reason Elaine is so impatient with him and sort of mean to him is because, well, over their long relationship, he's more than earned it. We also see that he's not very respectful of his boss. I mean, it seems justified at the time. His boss is being mean to him, and so he retorts, and then he goes to the bar and he's really proud of himself for his comeback. But if Elaine is just sort of setting him straight because he actually is a crappy employee, sneaking off to drink and never having any money, never getting his work done. And then, yeah, it really just makes me think, well, Elaine maybe sort of had a point. Starfleet Bat also said, I did not like Farrington at all at any point in the story. The part about the dirty eyes made me wonder about him, as generally dirty eyes means illness, like liver failure, and that can be related to alcoholism sometimes. And the way he was described and the setting, it just felt like that was it. So I guessed right from the start. I thought ill of him. But it was when he had the urge to drink in Elaine's office and started to obsess over getting some money for drinks that it was confirmed for me. Farrington would probably be dead in 5 years. If the drinking didn't kill him, then the war probably would have. This was written around 1914, right? It doesn't say what year the story is set, but World War I started in 1914, so... But if, for some reason, he didn't die and didn't go to war, I would imagine in 5 years it would be worse for the family. Farrington would probably be fired at some point. Then he'd be angrier and more hostile towards his family, and likely drinking more. I don't foresee a happy ending for them, really. I think it's set about a decade or so earlier. I don't know why I had that in my head, but I just think it's set around the turn of the century, so late 1800s, early 1900s. But still, I think you're right. I very, very much doubt that he's going to recover from his alcoholism, and unless he gets incredibly lucky, wins the jackpot somehow, things are not going to turn out good for him and his family. Alright, what a story, eh? It was actually quite a good story, as depressing as that ending was. I mean, that was just heart-wrenching. But, a good story. It did leave me with that just feeling of... I don't know, like, I really dislike that character. And you just want to kind of wring his neck, don't you? But, hey, what are you going to do? Let's move on to the next story, shall we? This is... Clay, Story 10 from Dubliners by James Joyce, and it goes a little bit like this. The matron had given her leave to go out as soon as the women's tea was over, and Maria looked forward to her evening out. The kitchen was spick and span. The cook said you could see yourself in the big copper boilers. The fire was nice and bright, and on one of the side tables were four very big balm bracts. These balm bracts seemed uncut, but if you went closer, you could see that they had been cut into long, thick, even slices and were ready to be handed around at tea. Maria had cut them herself. Maria was a very, very small person indeed, but she had a very long nose and a very long chin. She talked a little through her nose, always soothingly. Yes, my dear, and no, my dear. She was always sent for when the women quarrelled over their tubs, and always succeeded in making peace. One day the matron had said to her, Maria, you are a veritable peacemaker. And the sub-matron and two of the bored ladies had heard the compliment. And Ginger Mooney was always saying that she wouldn't do to the dummy who had charge of the irons if it wasn't for Maria. Everyone was so fond of Maria. The women would have their tea at 6 o'clock and she would be able to get away before 7. From Ball's Bridge to the Pillar, 20 minutes. From the Pillar to Drumcondra, 20 minutes, and 20 minutes to buy the things. She would be there before 8. She took out her purse with the silver clasps and read again the words, A present from Belfast. She was very fond of that purse because Joe had brought it to her 5 years before when he and Alfie had gone to Belfast on a Whit Monday trip. In the purse were 2 half-crowns and some coppers. She would have 5 shillings clear after paying tram fare. What a nice evening they would have, all the children singing. Only she hoped that Joe wouldn't come in drunk. He was so different when he took any drink. Often he had wanted her to go and live with them, but she would have felt herself in the way, though Joe's wife was ever so nice with her, and she had become accustomed to the life of the laundry. Joe was a good fellow. She had nursed him and Alfie too, and Joe used to say, Mama is Mama, but Maria is my proper mother. After the breakup at home, the boys had got her that position in the Dublin by Lamplight Laundry, and she liked it. She used to have such a bad opinion of Protestants, but now she thought they were very nice people, a little quiet and serious, but still very nice people to live with. Then she had her plants in the conservatory, and she liked looking after them. She had lovely ferns and wax plants, and whenever anyone came to visit her, she always gave the visitor one or two slips from her conservatory. There was one thing she didn't like, and that was the tracts on the walks. But the matron was such a nice person to deal with, so genteel. When the cook told her everything was ready, she went into the woman's room and began to pull the big bell. In a few minutes, the women began to come in by twos and threes, wiping their steaming hands in the petticoats and pulling down the sleeves of their blouses over their red steaming arms. They settled down before their huge mugs, which the cook and the dummy filled up with hot tea, already mixed with milk and sugar in huge tin cans. Maria superintended the distribution of the barmbrack and saw that every woman got her four slices. There was a great deal of laughing and joking during the meal. Lizzie Fleming said Maria was sure to get the ring, and though Fleming had said that for so many Hallow Eves, Maria had to laugh and say she didn't want any ring or man either. And when she laughed, her green-grey eyes sparkled with disappointed shyness, and the tip of her nose nearly met the tip of her chin. Then Ginger Mooney lifted her mug of tea and proposed Maria's health, while all the other women clattered with their mugs on the table and said she was sorry she hadn't a sup of porter to drink it in. And Maria laughed again till the tip of her nose nearly met the tip of her chin, until her minute body nearly shook itself asunder, because she knew that Mooney meant well, though, of course, she had the notions of a common woman. But wasn't Maria glad when the women had finished their tea and the cook and the dummy had begun to clear away the tea things? She went into her little bedroom and, remembering that the next morning was a mass morning, changed the hand of the alarm from 7 to 6. Then she took off her working skirt and her house boots and laid her best skirt out on the bed and her tiny dress boots beside the foot of the bed. She changed her blouse too, and as she stood before the mirror, she thought of how she used to dress for Mass on Sunday morning when she was a young girl, and she looked with quaint affection at the diminutive body which she had so often adorned. In spite of its years, she found it a nice, tidy little body. When she got outside, the streets were shining with rain, and she was glad of her old brown waterproof. The tram was full, and she had to sit on the little stool at the end of the car, facing all the people with her toes barely touching the floor. She arranged in her mind all she was going to do, and thought how much better it was to be independent, and to have your own money in your pocket. She hoped they would have a nice evening. She was sure they would, but she could not help thinking what a pity it was Alfie and Joe were not speaking. They were always falling out now, but when they were boys together they used to be the best of friends, but such was life. She got out of her tram at the pillar and ferreted her way quickly among the crowds. She went into Down's cake shop, but the shop was so full of people that it was a long time before she could get herself attended to. She bought a dozen of mixed penny cakes and at last came out of the shop laden with a big bag. Then she thought, what else would she buy? She wanted to buy something really nice. They would be sure to have plenty of apples and nuts. It was hard to know what to buy, and all she could think of was cake. She decided to buy some plum cake, but Down's plum cake had not enough almond icing on top of it, so she went over to a shop in Henry Street. Here she was a long time in suiting herself, and stylish young lady behind the counter, who was evidently a little annoyed at her, asked her was it wedding cake she wanted to buy. That made Maria blush and smile at the young lady, but the young lady took it all very seriously and finally cut a thick slice of plum cake, parcelled it up, and said, two and four, please. She thought she would have to stand in the Drumconda tram because none of the young men seemed to notice her, but an elderly gentleman made room for her. He was a stout gentleman and wore a brown hard hat. He had a square red face and a greyish moustache. Maria thought he was a colonel-looking gentleman, and she reflected how much more polite he was than the young men who simply stared straight before them. The gentleman began to chat with her about Hallow Eve and the rainy weather. He supposed the bag was full of good things for the little ones, and said it was only right that the youngsters should enjoy themselves while they were young. Maria agreed with him, and favoured him with demure nods and hems. He was very nice with her, and when she was getting out at the canal bridge, she thanked him and bowed, and he bowed to her and raised his hat and smiled agreeably, and while she was going up along the terrace, bending her tiny head under the rain, she thought how easy it was to know a gentleman, even when he has a drop taken. Everybody said, "Oh, here's Maria," when she came to Joe's house. Joe was there, having come home from business, and all the children had their Sunday dresses on. There were two big girls in from next door, and games were going on. Maria gave the bag of cakes to the eldest boy, Alfie, to divide, and Mrs. Donnelly said it was too good of her to bring such a big bag of cakes, and made all the children say, "Thanks, Maria." But Maria said she had brought something special for Papa and Mama, something they would be sure to like, and she began to look for her plum cake. She tried in Down's bag, and then in the pockets of her waterproof, and then in the hall stand, but nowhere could she find it. Then she asked all the children had any of them eaten it, by mistake, of course, but the children all said no, and looked as if they did not like to eat cakes, if they were to be accused of stealing. Somebody had a solution for the mystery, and Mrs. Donnelly said it was plain that Maria had left it behind her in the tram. Maria, remembering how confused the gentleman with the greyish mustache had made her, coloured with shame and vexation and disappointment. At the thought of the failure of her little surprise and of the 2 and 4 pence she had thrown away for nothing, she nearly cried outright. But Joe said it didn't matter, and made her sit down by the fire. He was very nice with her. He told her all that went on in his office, repeating for her a smart answer which he made to the manager. Maria did not understand why Joe laughed so much over the answer he had made, but she said that the manager must have been a very overbearing person to deal with. Joe said he wasn't so bad when you knew how to take him, that he was a decent sort, so long as you didn't rub him the wrong way. Mrs. Donnelly played the piano for the children, and they danced and sang. Then the 2 next-door girls handed round the nuts. Nobody could find the nutcrackers, and Joe was nearly getting cross over it, and asked how did they expect Maria to crack nuts without a nutcracker. But Maria said she didn't like nuts, and that they weren't to bother about her. Then Joe asked would she take a bottle of stout, and Mrs. Donnelly said there was port wine too in the house, if she would prefer that. Maria said she would rather they didn't ask her to take anything, but Joe insisted. So Maria let him have his way, and they sat by the fire, talking over old times, and Maria thought she would put in a good word for Alfie. But Joe cried that God might strike him stone dead if he ever spoke a word to his brother again, and Maria said she was sorry she had mentioned the matter. Mrs. Donnelly told her husband it was a great shame for him to speak that way of his own flesh and blood, but Joe said that Alfie was no brother of his, and there was nearly being a row on the head of it. But Joe said he would not lose his temper on account of the night it was, and asked his wife to open some more stout. The 2 next-door girls had arranged some Hallow Eve games, and soon everything was merry again. Maria was delighted to see the children so merry, and Joe and his wife in such good spirits. The next-door girls put some saucers on the table, and then led the children up to the table blindfolded. One got the prayer book, and the other three got the water, and when one of the next-door girls got the ring, Mrs. Donnelly shook her finger at the blushing girl, as much as to say, "Oh, I know all about it." They insisted then on blindfolding Maria and leading her up to the table to see what she would get, and while they were putting on the bandage, Maria laughed and laughed until the tip of her nose nearly met the tip of her chin. They led her up to the table amid laughing and joking, and she put her hand out in the air as she was told to. She moved her hand about here and there in the air and descended on one of the saucers. She felt a soft, wet substance with her fingers, and was surprised that nobody spoke or took off her bandage. There was a pause for a few seconds, and then a great deal of scuffling and whispering. Somebody said something about the garden, and at last Mrs. Donnelly said something very cross to one of the next-door girls, and told her to throw it out at once. That was no play. Maria understood that it was wrong that time, and so she had to do it over again, and this time she got the prayer book. After that, Mrs. Donnelly played Miss McLeod's reel for the children, and Joe made Maria take a glass of wine. Soon they were all quite merry again, and Mrs. Donnelly said Maria would enter a convent before the year was out because she had got the prayer book. Maria had never seen Joe so nice to her as he was that night, so full of pleasant talk and reminiscences. She said they were all very good to her. At last the children grew tired and sleepy, and Joe asked Maria would she not sing some little song before she went, one of the old songs. Mrs. Donnelly said, "Do please, Maria." And so Maria had to get up and stand beside the piano. Mrs. Donnelly bade the children be quiet and listen to Maria's song. Then she played the prelude and said, "Now, Maria." And Maria, blushing very much, began to sing in a tiny, quavering voice. She sung, "I dreamt that I dwelt." And when she came to the second verse, she sang again, "I dreamt that I dwelt in marble halls with vassals and serfs at my side, and of all who assembled within those walls, that I was the hope and the pride. I had riches too great to count, could boast of a high ancestral name, but I also dreamt, which pleased me most, that you loved me still the same." But no one tried to show her her mistake, and when she had ended her song, Joe was very much moved. He said that there was no time like the long ago, and no music for him like poor old Balfe, whatever other people might say, and his eyes filled up so much with tears that he could not find what he was looking for, and in the end he had to ask his wife to tell him where the corkscrew was. All right, there we go. Another story down. That was Clay. Clay. Not really sure why it's called Clay. To ask you guys, all right, have your say about this short story at reddit.com/r/thehemingwaylist. I will start the conversation with a few discussion prompts, and I look forward to hearing what you guys have to say about this one. Other than that, thank you all very much for listening today, and I will see you tomorrow.